You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
That's best.
All right, please. Please offer.
All right, thank you. Please be seated. Okay, we're back on the record on case CR 22-21-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. Detective Werther's on the stand. I'll remind the witness you're still under oath for your testimony. And Ms. Blake, you were conducting direct, if you'd like to continue. And if you're still publishing the Exhibit 43, you can do that as well.
Thank you. And we may need to go back one screen.
I think more than one. There are a few auto advances, and I think they did their thing while we were away. Okay.
And I think this is a slide we left on, correct?
I believe so.
And again, to remind the jurors, what were we seeing on this slide?
This was GPS location data extracted from Charles Vallow's phone, and this represented that at about 7:50 in the morning, the device left the area of the Four Peaks address that we have been discussing. I had mentioned that that's about 18 minutes after the device arrived and about 46 minutes before the call would be made to 911.
And I think we talked about it, but I believe Lori had indicated she had Charles' phone with her.
That is what she had claimed, yes.
And if we go to the next slide,
okay,
what are we seeing on this slide?
This slide is representing these are those H planes we had discussed before, indicating where a device most likely was at the time an event happened. This event is actually a call that should have stayed up. This is a call made between Alex and Lori, between Alex's device and Lori's device, rather, and shows that at 7:52, the auto advance is going to keep doing that. At 7:52, you can see the devices are communicating, and it shows the most likely location where those two devices were at that point.
So Lori and Alex's device were communicating?
Correct. That was a voice call at 7:52 between the two. Recall the claim had been made that after the shooting, that Alex and Lori communicated via phone. And this is one of a few instances I found where there was a voice call between their devices.
And that was before the 911 call?
Before the 911 call. We've not got to the 911 call yet.
And then what are we seeing here?
These would be those overlapping H planes. So the blue represents the most likely area for Ms. Vallow's device to have been. And the green is the most likely area for Alex Cox's device to have been. The green, of course, includes the Four Peaks address, and the blue includes the Burger King we're going to talk about momentarily.
All right. And if we go forward?
Yes.
And what are we seeing here?
This is location data derived from Charles Vallow's device, which shows that at about 7:55, it was in the area of that Burger King on Ocotillo Road that we previously highlighted.
And if we go forward, what is this slide telling us?
This is my way of... We talked about wanting to corroborate data and then or refute the data if it turns out to be the case that the data isn't reliable, and also to test the various claims. So if it is true that Lori Vallow was in possession of Charles Vallow's phone at this point, then that location data in the Burger King parking lot area would also be representative of where Ms. Vallow likely was. That would show the data set were apparently reliable, and it would also show that Ms. Vallow appeared to have the phone. So to test those claims, we look for that evidence. And one of the things I did in order to look for that evidence is go to that Burger King to view that video and see if, in fact, we saw Ms. Vallow.
And did you, in fact, do that?
Yes.
And if we move forward, then what are we going to see in these next slides?
So these will be three different video clips recovered from the Burger King location. I went there and I viewed them in person, and then they were later provided by the Burger King security personnel. You see the timestamp of 7:54. One of the things I do and that I did in this case is while I was at the Burger King, I checked what their video system time thought the time was, and I checked that against my work cell phone, which I know to be reliable. And it showed that their timestamps appeared to be accurate. So this 7:54 is roughly accurate to the time.
And is this particular vehicle one associated with Lori Vallow?
It is. I personally observed this vehicle not the day of the shooting, but the next day. This red Kia Sorento with this particular Colorado plate that you see up on the screen. I went to the Four Peaks address on the 12th and I saw that vehicle. And just for reference, I think I've enlarged the area where the plate is to show that it seems to be generally consistent with those characters.
And do you recall learning that Lori indicated she'd heard the shot?
That's what I was told, yes.
And yet she's at the Burger King at approximately 7:54?
That's right.
And the 911 call does not come in until about 8:36?
That's right.
Okay. And then if we go forward?
Video from the drive-through that momentarily will show a person that I recognize as Ms. Lori Vallow, having seen her in person.
And from this video, could you tell who was in the vehicle with her?
I can tell that there's at least one other person in the vehicle. I personally can't see that person clearly enough to say who that person is.
And were you aware that Lori indicated she'd left the residence with both of her children?
That's right.
And do you recall the approximate distance from this Burger King and the residence Lori was residing at the time?
I said it earlier, it was 1 point something miles. I don't recall what followed the decimal.
Fairly close distance then.
Relatively.
And again, according to Lori, she'd already heard the shot. So at this time, according to Lori, Charles was already shot.
According to her claim, yes.
And she's at a Burger King drive-thru.
Correct.
And what are we seeing in this slide?
This is the video from the drive-thru after the order has been accepted, and it'll show the vehicle leaving at 7:55 a.m.
And was this consistent with where Charles' phone location showed his phone?
That's correct.
And what are we seeing on this slide?
This just goes back to that claim. So now we have, if we see Lori there, we see Charles's phone puts the phone location data in that general area. So this would suggest that the claim that she had the phone is supported by this evidence.
And if we move forward, what are we seeing here?
This is going to be another call, I believe, between Alex Cox's phone and Lori Vallow's phone, and also location data extracted from Charles's phone. And as the animation continues, there will come a point where the H plane from the phone call for Lori Vallow will be overlaid, I believe. Yes, there it is. And you'll see, as I mentioned before, the H plane is where the device is likely to have been. And then Charles Vallow's GPS data also is within that H plane. So those devices are indicated to have been in the same general area. And there is Alex's H plane in green, showing an area that does include the Four Peaks address. And these are the details for each of those calls coming up on the screen now.
And if we move forward? Yep.
So the claim had been made that Ms. Vallow stopped at a drugstore to buy flip-flops or sandals for at least for herself and at least one of the children. This is location data from Charles' device, showing it arriving at around 8:08 in the area of a Walgreens on Lindsay. It does not stay for very long, and then actually is going to go to a different drugstore, also Walgreens, I believe. This, I believe, is at 8:16. That'll come up in a moment at a Walgreens on 785 South Cooper. Yes, that's 8:16. And these are the location data from Charles's phone again.
And again, she's at a Walgreens prior to any call being made to 911.
Call to 911 has not yet been made.
If we continue.
So that slide is redundant, sorry. This would be the video that I recovered from that Walgreens, showing that at 8:16 on their timestamp, Ms. Lori Vallow walks in. And there's the register view of her buying the sandals as claimed.
And did this match up with the location data on Charles' phone?
Yes. Again, you know, everything has an error rate, but the device is in the area of this Walgreens at the same time.
And again, this is presumably after Charles has been shot, according to Lori?
According to Lori.
And again, prior to the 911 call being made.
Correct. So now we're at 8:20 and the video shows Ms. Vallow walking out.
And then what are we seeing here?
This is the location data from Charles of the device again, picking up over by Gilbert Road and then transitioning down towards the Lawrence Life Academy. You see that one data point that's in the area of the academy in the parking lot. And that data point's details will come up in a moment, and I believe it's 8:20 in the morning. Oh, sorry, 8:32. My apologies.
And again, Lawrence Academy is where JJ was attending school.
That's right.
And if we move forward, what are we seeing here?
This is going to show Charles Vallow's device location at the time that the 911 call was placed by Alex Cox. So that's the device location in red on Gilbert Road, north of the freeway. And that is the H plane for the 911 call made from Alex's Cox device, which initiated the police investigation in this matter. This, for reference, is about 63 minutes after the device location data from Charles's phone first arrived in the area of Four Peaks in the morning.
If we move forward.
This brings us back to that CAD call showing again that it's 8:36, just so that we're oriented. We're back to that point that I brought us to earlier.
And if we go to the next slide, what are we seeing here?
This is going to be the phone location data from Charles's device in transit down towards the Four Peaks address. There's a point just north of the freeway right now. And then it should pick up and show it arriving in the area of Four Peaks. This is the detail for one of those data points showing that it's about 8:49 in the morning that you see the device is now in the area of the Four Peaks address.
And did that correspond with the time Lori arrived back at that residence?
It did.
And if we go to the next slide, what are we seeing here?
So this is taken from Officer Krautheim's body-worn video, and one sees Lori and Tylee arriving, and I noticed that the flip-flops do appear similar to the ones that we just saw purchased, so I've highlighted those. And then because the way he had his camera oriented, I have to turn the timestamp over for it to be read. And this is represented in Zulu time, which is also GMT, so you subtract 7 hours, you get 8:48 in the morning Arizona time. So again, the data from Charles' device is once again corroborated by something independent, in this case, the officer's body-worn video.
And if we move forward from here, what are we seeing?
This is more data corroboration. So there is an incoming call to Charles' device at 10:25. And the center of the screen where I've labeled Chandler PD, that's where the Chandler Police Department main station is. So what I did to check that is if he was at the main station, there would be evidence of that. And I see that at 10:25, there's Alex in one of the interview rooms.
And there's an indication that it was a missed call from M. Boudreaux.
Right.
Do you know who that is in reference to?
I'm aware that that person's related to this case. I'm not fully aware of the facts of their involvement.
And would it be Melanie Boudreaux?
That's right.
And if we go forward from here?
This is another incoming call. 10:26, again, showing the H-plane does cover the area of the Chandler Police Department. And to corroborate that, there we are at 10:26 with Alex in the interview room.
And it shows a missed call from an S. Shiflett. Do you know who that was in reference to?
Yeah, I think the name is Summer Shiflett.
Do you know if she's Alex Cox's sister?
I believe that's right.
And this is Alex in an interview room?
Yes.
If we go to the next one, what are we seeing here?
This shows that at about 10:40, that's Detective Nate Moffitt there. He's returning some items to Alex, and that includes Alex's cell phone. So we've been seeing those missed calls and the indication the device was in the area of that H-plane, and there is the device.
And I think you said 10:40. Would it have been approximately 11:40?
Yes, thank you.
And if we move forward from here, what are we seeing on this slide?
This is an incoming call to Alex's device at 12:10, and the H-plane once again covers the Four Peaks address.
And if we go forward from here, what are we seeing?
This is going back to the location data for Charles's device. That was the location data from the point at 8:49 when it arrived back at Four Peaks, all the way to 12:13, where we see it depart the area of Four Peaks.
And Charles Vallow has been declared deceased by this time?
Yes, that's right.
If we go forward, what are we seeing here?
This is going to show the movement of the location data from Charles's device north and east to an area by the freeway. And it will show a voice call with Lori Vallow and shows that the H-plane again is overlapping the area where one sees GPS location data from Charles's device. And you see that those are within 2 minutes, really a little bit less than 2 minutes of one another. There's a 12:34 and 12:36 on those, showing that they're in the same general area at the same time.
And if we go to the next slide, what are we seeing here?
This should show a text from the 0143 number we've been considering attributed to Chad Daybell. To Lori Vallow's 9562 number. And this is mapping the location data for that event from Mr. Daybell's records, indicating that his device is now in the area of Salt Lake City, Utah.
And did you determine an approximate time on that text?
Yes, it's showing 12:39 on the slider. And I think the actual record's going to come up here momentarily and show that. Yes, 12:39.
And again, were you able to look at the content of that message?
That's not available to me.
And if we move forward?
Maybe frozen. Standby. It's not reacting on my end. Do you have the actual computer?
And hey, I'm also not getting any reaction.
That's less than ideal.
Your Honor, if we may take a momentary recess.
Yes.
And Detective Werther, is it going to be best if I close out and reopen it?
Be my best guess. If you hit escape, so we're not presenter view, and we'll see if we can note what slide we were on. That'll make it easier. But if it's not reacting at all, I think we'll have to just quit it and reopen it.
And I think it has frozen up. Your Honor, I'm going to unpublish it.
Okay.
And I believe it may take about 5 minutes to get it back up and running if we want to take a stretch break.
Okay. We can, we'll go ahead and do that. Everyone like to stand up if they want. Ma'am.
Okay. I think we are back up and running.
All right.
Thank you for your patience. Detective Werther, I think I went back a slide, but you'd been talking about a text between Chad and Lori's device.
That's right.
And then what do we see on these next slides?
So briefly as well, I may have misspoken. This is an incoming text from Lori to Chad.
And then if we move forward.
See if it'll advance now. It will not for me. Is there a chance you could hit an enter key or an arrow key?
I'm going to see if I reconnect the mouse, if it lets you. No.
Let's see. Yeah, I'm right clicking and it's coming up with nothing. It should come up with a menu. If you hit enter, will it advance?
Without the HDMI cable, it was. Let me see.
While you're working on that, I'll just note there is, as an aside, they're doing recarpeting, and that's what you may hear going on. There's furniture and other things being moved around, so that's also why we're going to have our afternoon end when it does tomorrow. But so I just wanted to make sure no one was concerned if they're feeling or hearing what's going on in the courthouse.
And Your Honor, may we approach briefly?
Yes. All right. Ms. Blake, we discussed proceeding with a different witness right now while you work on the technical issue on this, and I believe the state does have another witness we could call. With that, are you moving to allow this witness on direct to step down and have another witness start direct at this time?
Yes, Your Honor, that would be the state's request.
Okay. Any objection to that, Mr. Pryor?
No objection, Judge.
All right. Detective Werther, you'll still be under oath clearly and under subpoena, so don't discuss your trial testimony with anyone during the recess. At some point, you will likely be recalled to continue in testimony with your direct examination, but in order to keep things moving, I'm going to permit a state's another witness to be called at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the state would call Tara Martinez.
You solemnly swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Thank you.
All right. The witness has been sworn at this time. Mr. What is this witness subject to the exclusionary order?
Your Honor, I guess there'd be an argument that she is not. Having said that, I don't believe she's watched any trial testimony from this trial.
Okay. And again, that's sometimes not all that easy to figure out who or would or wouldn't be subject to it. But I will inquire, have you been watching any of the trial testimony since this case began?
No, sir.
You haven't viewed it on the online feed or in the courtroom at all?
No.
Have you talked to anybody else about their testimony?
No.
Okay, then Mr. Wood, you can inquire on direct. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ma'am.
Good afternoon.
Can you state your name and spell it for the record?
Yes, Tara Martinez, M-A-R-T-I-N-E-Z.
And how are you employed?
With Idaho State Police Forensic Services.
What is your title there?
Forensic Scientist 2.
And what does Forensic Scientist 2 do?
It depends what section of the laboratory you're in. So I'm in the latent print section. So that means that I process items of evidence to try to find fingerprints, and then I may compare those prints and may run them through a database, and then I also respond to crime scenes.
And how long have you been with the Idaho State Lab?
8 years.
And do you have any special training to accomplish your job duties?
So first, I have a Bachelor's of Science in Biological Science with a minor in Chemistry and a specialization in Forensic Science. And then once I was employed with Idaho State Police, I went through an extensive training program, which included practical exercises, readings, tests, and some external training and different training classes outside of the laboratory.
And are you a member of any professional organizations related to your job?
Yes, I'm a member of the International Association for Identification, as well as their Pacific Northwest Division.
You mentioned earlier that you process latent prints. What are latent prints?
So latent print means an impression that's left unintentionally. So I may touch this desk here, and I may be able to leave an impression behind. Generally, these impressions aren't easy to see. They need to be enhanced or processed in some way to be able to visualize them.
And what is the process used to develop a latent print for purposes of your examination?
It really depends on the item. So when I receive an item into the laboratory, I'm first looking at the item to try to decide which methods I'm going to use. The first thing I'm looking at is the item porous or non-porous, meaning porous, like paper, absorbs water, and non-porous obviously repels water, like a water bottle, piece of plastic, things like that. And then once I've determined that, I may look at the color of the item or the texture of the item, and these things may help me decide which process I'm going to use, mainly, though, depending upon whether it's porous or non-porous.
And when people touch something, do they always leave a latent print?
No, it depends on a lot of different factors. They can be broken down into little categories. So the first being pre-touch, like meaning the person. So some people leave really good prints behind. Really depends on how much they sweat. Maybe if they touch their other parts of their face or their body a lot, they'll have oil on their hands. So those are person factors, those are before you touch the item. And then you have touch factors, meaning if you touch an item, how likely is it you're going to leave something behind? And that depends a lot on the item itself. Is the item dirty? Is it dusty? Is it textured? Those kinds of things would mean that you probably wouldn't leave a latent print behind very easily. And then the post-touch factors, meaning is the item left outside a lot? Is it raining? Is the print going to be evaporated by the sun? And then how the item is packaged. So there's a variety of factors to determine whether or not a latent print is left behind.
If a latent print is left behind, how is it that you would collect a latent print?
So again, it really depends on the item. Let's say, for instance, I have just a normal piece of plastic. It's non-porous item. There's just plain old plastic. So in that case, I first do a visual examination, and I'm looking here to see first if I see any prints that someone may have left just incidentally. Maybe they have some oil on their hands. So maybe they have more skin cells on their hands and they've just left a print. So I'm first looking for that. I'm also looking at the item to see if there's any other forensic evidence that might be important. Like, are there hairs on the item? Is there a lint on the item? And those things I'm collecting at that point. Then I move on to a different visual examination where I'm using different colors of light to try to see if I can see any prints that may be fluorescing. If you touch other things and then touch an item, you could leave a print behind that is fluorescent. Makeup, for instance, is fluorescent. So I'm looking to see if I see any of those kinds of prints. After that, I move on to super glue fuming. It's very similar to what you may have seen on CSI. It's super glue. It goes in a chamber, and the chamber controls the heat and the humidity. And basically, the super glue just comes into the air and attaches to any moisture on the item. And because latent prints are made of a lot of water, it will attach the latent prints. And this is helpful because the glue makes the prints more visible because it's white now, and it also makes them less likely to be wiped away. And then I move on to a dye stain, which stains the entire item, but will more adhere to those prints that I've previously glued. And then lastly would be a powder, depending upon the type of item.
When you say powder, is that like the dusting?
Yeah, so it's usually black powder, but it's with a brush.
And if any of those processes work and you're able to develop a latent print, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the correct terminology, develop the print or?
Yeah, develop a print, okay. Yep.
How do you go about comparing it to another print or a person?
First, if I see any prints during any of those steps, I'm preserving them at each step that I see the prints. And then at that point, once the processing is done, then it either moves to myself or another analyst to do comparison, what we call comparison process. So that process is kind of a long acronym, but it's ACE-V, which is ACE-V. So the A stands for analysis. So I'm looking at the print to determine, do I know where this print came from? Meaning, is it from a palm? Is it from a finger? Is it from the side of a finger? Do I know the location of the print? And then I also look at any kind of distortion. Every print you leave behind, you're making some type of distortion. So I'm looking at, do I see smears? Do I see voids in the print? Things like that. And then once I analyze the print and I say, yep, this print looks good, I'm going to move it on to comparison, then I can pull generally fingerprint cards from the persons involved that the agency has let us know about. And then I do a back and forth comparison between an unknown and a known. Unknown, again, being the latent print. And I'm doing a back and forth comparison to see if the features I saw previously in my analysis phase, are they there in the known print? And not just are they there, but do they look similar to each other? Is their spacing the same? Things like that. And then the E stands for evaluation. So at that point, I'm saying, okay, I've done my comparison. What's my answer? Is this print from this source of this known or not from the source? Are they the same source? And then at that point, I'll make my determination. And then V stands for verification, where another analyst goes through and does the whole thing over again.
Okay. And so just to kind of summarize that, you look at the print, determine if it's sufficient to make a comparison.
Yes, sir.
All right. And then you attempt to make the comparison.
Yes.
You evaluate that and then have it verified by someone else.
Yes.
And you mentioned that, how do you compare it to someone else? You mentioned a print card.
So known prints are taken from people for various reasons. And so there is a database of known prints that I can access. So if I know who the agency would like this compared against, I know the persons involved, the victims, et cetera, then I'll pull cards from that database and be able to compare against them.
And do you ever sometimes go out and get prints from an individual so that you'll have something to compare your latent print with?
Yes, sometimes the record isn't very good. Like the fingerprint card that was previously taken is of poor quality, or maybe I need areas of skin that weren't recorded, things like that. And we'll go out and take prints from known individuals for that reason.
Are you familiar with, from the year 2020, lab number 2233?
Yes.
What is that lab number associated with?
It is the Lori Vallow and Chad Day Bell case.
All right. And did that involve JJ Vallow and Tylee Ryan as well?
Yes.
What was your first contact with that lab number?
My first contact was taking prints at the coroner's office. I assisted Rexburg Police Department with that.
And what did you do at the coroner's office?
I took known prints from the victim, JJ.
And did you have any other contact with that case?
Yes, I did some processing of that, of different items that were submitted in this case. And then I also took known prints of two other people, Lori Vallow and Chad Daybill.
All right. And did you collect any other samples from them besides known prints?
Yes, I also took buccal swabs. That's a swab to obtain cheek cells and saliva in the mouth for DNA.
And did you collect any hair samples?
Yes, I also did that.
Did you obtain any known samples for an Alex Cox?
Yes.
What were those?
I got two different samples. One was a standard fingerprint card where you're recording all 10 fingers. That was from the Federal Bureau of Investigation database. Like I said, you can be in there for a variety of reasons. And then the second cards I received were from the Gilbert Police Department that they submitted to me.
And the Gilbert Police Department, do you know why they had his fingerprints?
They said they were from his autopsy.
Did you do, referring to this lab number, did you do any actual latent print examinations?
Yes.
Can you tell us what items you did that on?
Yeah. So I checked out and processed items 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 18.
And did you process those items to search for prints?
Yes.
Okay. So let's, do you recall what item 10 was?
Yes. Item 10 was a white drawstring bag, like a trash bag, with gray colored pieces of duct tape attached to it. And per the agency, that was the bag around the head of JJ.
And were you able to develop any prints on that bag?
No.
Next was, I believe, item 11.
Yes.
What was that?
Item 11 was a mass of plastic and gray colored pieces of duct tape said to be plastic and body bag JJ.
And without getting into the specifics of that, were you able to develop any latent prints on that item?
Yes.
Okay. And we'll come back to that in a minute. I believe the next item was 12.
12.
What was that?
12 was one piece of gray colored duct type tape, and that was reported to be from the mouth of JJ.
And were you able to process any prints on that?
I did not get any prints on that, no.
Okay. And item 13?
Item 13 was one mass of gray-colored duct-type tape, and that was said to be from the ankles of JJ.
Were you able to develop any prints there?
Yes.
And item 14?
Also one mass of gray-colored duct-type tape said to be from the hands of JJ.
And I believe the last item, was it 18?
18, yes.
And what was that?
One green-colored piece of plastic with Lydica Corporation written on it, and it was said to be a green bucket from bag 2 of 3 from Tylee.
And were you able to develop any prints from that?
No.
Right. From any of those items, were you able to collect any hairs?
Yes.
Where were you able to collect hairs?
Items 10, 11, 13, and 14.
And just briefly, let's talk about item 13. You said you were able to develop some prints from that.
Yes.
Were you able to do any successful comparison with those prints?
I did comparison. I don't know the word successful is, I'm not sure.
Okay.
Let me explain. So I was able to develop two latent prints from item 13. Those were 13.1 and 13.2. And 13.2 was established once it was in the comparison phase, it was established that it was not enough rich detail for comparison. So at that point, there's nothing further to do. There's no comparison to be made. Whereas 13.1 was enough to compare and moved on to the comparison stage, but no identifications or exclusions could be made. So the print became inconclusive, and that was due to the quality of the latent print. So sometimes there's enough detail that you can do some comparison, but you may not be able to render a conclusion of identification or exclusion, and it kind of just gets stuck in the middle.
So inconclusive is maybe the better word than successful or unsuccessful.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
I'd like to talk to you about item 11. And if you can just briefly remind the jury what item 11 was.
Yes. Item 11 is black colored plastic and gray duct type tape. The item itself is composed of multiple pieces, so I labeled them separately. So 11.1 to 11.11 is the gray-colored duct-type tape, and then 11.12 to 11.15 is the plastic pieces.
And, Your Honor, I'm going to ask that the witness be handed what's been marked at State's Exhibit 210, and I do have a courtesy copy for counsel and the court. Ms. Martinez, are you familiar with Exhibit 210?
Yes.
When you, in anticipation of testifying before the jury today, did you prepare this exhibit?
Yes.
And what does that exhibit purport to be? Or what is the information contained in that exhibit? Let me ask that.
This contains the items broken down so that you can see photos of each of the items, as well as photos of each of the latent prints that were compared. And it includes what we call our charts, which is basically like my markup of the prints.
And Your Honor, I believe that this comes in by way of stipulation, but I would ask this exhibit, or let me ask a couple more questions. Did you prepare that in anticipation of testifying before a jury?
Yes.
And do you believe that that would help the jury understand both the work you did and the results you found?
Yes.
On this case? Your Honor, I'd ask that State's Exhibit 210 be entered into evidence.
Any objection?
Judge, it's entered by way of stipulation of the parties.
All right, then 210 is admitted, States 210.
And if I may publish, Your Honor.
Yes, you may.
Ms. Martinez, did this originate as a PowerPoint presentation?
Yes.
That's the software you used to create this?
Yes.
And Your Honor, I'll be just publishing through the Yelmo.
Okay.
Can you tell the jury what they're looking at on this page of the exhibit?
Yes. So on the left, you can see underneath it says item 11. So there's two different areas, I guess, of plastic on this photo. So the one on the left is what was processed, and the one on the right is what the one on the left came in. So it came in as this giant bag with bags inside. So the one on the right was not processed. And then on the right photo, where it says item 11.12, this is just 11.12, so being one of the pieces of plastic that was in that bundle. And then if you look at the top right there, you can see it says 11.12.1. So that's just an indication of where the latent print was on that item.
And if you can explain to the jury what they're seeing on the second page.
So this is just item 11.15. So just this piece of plastic, just this little guy here, is 11.15. And you can see there that I have marked 11.15.1, which is where the latent print 11.15.1 was located on the item.
If you can tell the jury what they're looking at here.
So this is latent print 11.12.1. This is it developed. So this is the way the photo, this is the exact photo that I took at the time when I developed the print.
And what are they seeing here?
And this is the same photo, but I enhanced it. So I took it into Photoshop and I made some changes to make it black and white instead of it being that yellow color, and up the contrast. So it's this, it's the same picture. It's just adjusted. And this is the analysis of the latent print. So I mentioned the charts earlier when I'm marking up the print, and analysis being the A of the methodology. So you can see here, there's a bunch of different dots on the screen, these yellows and these greens here. So those represent what I'm seeing. If the dot is green, I'm very confident at what I'm seeing. If the dot is yellow, I'm less confident, meaning I see features there. I just may not be sure what kind of feature it is, or maybe not exactly sure on the location. So this is my markup of the print. And then this is the comparison charting. As I said, the C in the methodology. So on the left, you have the latent print, and on the right, you have the known print. And this is my back and forth comparison between the two. You can see the dots that are blue. And then I numbered them for court reasons to correspond. So you can see the correspondence between the two.
All right. And I see it says comparison of latent print 11.12.1 to known print number 5, Cox. Is that referring to Alex Cox?
Yes. The conclusion at the end of this comparison was an identification to the card bearing the name Alexander Cox to number 5, meaning the right little finger.
Okay. And again, when it says item 11, it's referring to the black plastic that JJ's body was found in.
Yes. So this is the other latent print that was developed, 11.15.1. Again, this is the photo that was taken at the time when it was processed with the dye stain. And this is the same photo, but obviously enhanced, changed to black and white.
And is that, can you tell what body part that print is from?
In my analysis, I believe that I wrote that it was likely a palm. That is based on the flow I'm looking at here. You can also see that's much larger than the finger we just looked at. There's also some creases here and some other indicators that it's likely from a palm print.
And what's the jury seeing?
And this is, again, close up, and this is my analysis chart. So you can see here there's some greens and some yellows marking up this print. So this is what my analysis markup looked like. And then here's the comparison markup, again, in the blue dots. Those are the correspondence with the corresponding numbers. And the conclusion after the comparison was that 11.15.1 was identified to the right palm of the fingerprint card or the palm print card bearing the name Alexander Cox.
So just to be clear, this comparison matched up with the print of Alex Cox.
Yes.
And again, this is from item 11. So part of the black plastic bags wrapped around
JJ.
Ms. Martinez, were you able to verify any other fingerprints from anyone else? Oops, I'm sorry. On any of those items?
I was not able to identify anyone else.
All right. And you mentioned that you collected some hairs.
Yes.
What did you do with those hairs?
I put them, I collected them using adhesive notes. So usually I use like something like a post-it note. And I collected them and repackaged them in coin envelopes. And then they were returned with the item inside the item's original packaging.
And was that for other people to do different types of analysis?
Yes, I don't do hair analysis. So anything that I see that could be used for somebody else may want, like hair, lint, fibers, things like that, I will collect and save.
All right. Your Honor, I have no further questions at this time.
All right. All right, Mr. Pryor, cross-examination.
And Judge, before we start, I have Defense Exhibit 41 I'd like to have marked. And my understanding is that it's by stipulation of the parties.
Oh, yes.
All right. Can you explain what Exhibit 41 is, please?
That would be part of the report that Ms. Martinez prepared as part of this investigation.
Very well. If that's being offered, I'll just take that up at this time. Has the state been able to review Exhibit 41?
Yes, Your Honor. We have no objection.
Very well. Defense Exhibit 41 is admitted.
Judge, may I proceed?
Yes.
Ms. Martinez, would it be fair to say that plastic is a good conduit to obtain fingerprints?
Yes.
It's because of the nature of how plastic is manufactured. It has an oil-based production, which would allow for fingerprints to be easily placed upon that kind of a surface. Would that be fair?
Yes, it's a very good surface for laying prints, mostly just because it's non-porous and it does have a nice coating on it.
Right. And in this particular case, you were clearly able to identify a fingerprint of Alex Cox. Is that right?
Yes.
And a hand, the bottom of the heel of the hand of Alex Cox on this plastic. Is that right?
It wasn't the bottom, but yes, a piece of the palm. Yes.
The piece of the palm. Of
yes. Cox. Under the two fingers right here, the middle finger and the ring finger. So higher up in the hand.
Okay. And then I don't know if I saw this in your report. You collected hairs in your process of going through all of the plastic that you were provided. Is that right?
Yes.
Do you have a recollection of how many hairs you collected as a result of your analysis?
I have to look at my notes. It's written down in my notes, but it's not something that was reported at the time.
Do you have your notes with you?
Yes.
Are they at the table with counsel?
Yep.
Mr. Bailiff, could you provide the witness? And Judge, could she use those to refresh her recollection?
Yes. I'll have her identify them once they're there. Thank you. Mr. Bailiff, if you wouldn't mind, please hand those to the witness. And these are notes for you to refresh your recollection, but don't read directly from them or read them into the record unless the court allows you to do that.
Just to clarify, sir, just item 11 hairs, is that what you would like?
All of the hairs that were located on all of the plastic that was submitted to you.
All of the plastic. Okay.
All of the plastic.
My apologies. I have horrible allergies today.
And again, do you have a recollection of, after refreshing your recollection, do you recall how many hairs you sent off to the laboratory?
It's hard to say exactly how many because I collected them kind of as bundles and not every hair was collected individually.
Okay.
But it looks like about 50 different adhesive notes were used to collect them. And that's between items 10, 11, 13, and 14.
Okay. So there were a significant number of hairs that were located on the...
Yes, on all the plastic that was submitted.
And those hairs were sent off to Bode Laboratory, is that right?
I don't know where the hairs went. I just repackaged them.
Now, at any time, did you find all of those hairs on the first... run through, or was that over a process of time that you were examining the plastic?
It looks like over a process of time. So some of them were right away during the first visual, and then others were seen after multiple processes.
Okay. And after multiple processes, you were able to identify these two latent prints of Alex Cox. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And obviously, you've already noted that you are not... It's not within your department to deal with the latent prints. Is that right?
It's within my department to deal with the latent prints. I do latent prints.
I'm not.
Do you mean DNA?
DNA. Okay. I am so sorry.
No problem. Yeah, no, I don't do anything with DNA.
And I don't have allergies, so I don't have an excuse. other than Lori Vallow, Chad Daybell, and Alex Cox, were you at any time by law enforcement asked to do any analysis of any other people to do a comparison of any other prints?
No, I was asked to just do the comparisons for the people that were involved. So JJ, Lori, and Chad were the only people that I compared against.
Okay. And law enforcement determined who were involved in this. Is that right?
Yes. And that's pretty standard. We don't know their investigation, so they let us know who they would like us to look at.
They set the criteria as to who you want to have hairs and prints tested against. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, Judge, I have nothing else. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pryor. Redirect, Mr. Wood?
Your Honor, the state has no redirect.
All right, Ms. Martinez, and that will conclude your testimony. Does the state intend to keep her under subpoena or recall her?
Your Honor, I believe she can be released from her subpoena.
From the defense?
Judge, I'm sorry, I didn't hear Mr. Wood's response.
The state would allow her to be released from a subpoena and not recall her as the defense.
And Judge, I'm sorry, I also subpoenaed Ms. Martinez, and I'm going to release her today as well from the subpoena I had served upon her.
Okay, thank you. So that will conclude your testimony. Thank you for appearing this afternoon, and you can go ahead and step down. We could have a sidebar, please, with counsel.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.